Welcome to Leveraging the Immune System for Therapeutic Benefit in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, a special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 American Association of Cancer Research annual meeting in Atlanta. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program features the perspectives of four leading clinical investigators in the management of patients with non-small cell lung cancer, Drs. Corey Langer, Vali Papadimitra-Kupulu, Naya Rizvi, and David Spiegel. In this program, you'll hear the faculty panel discuss a variety of clinical and translational issues, and separately on this program are the faculty slide presentations. As a prelude to our initial discussion on the landmark PACIFIC trial demonstrating the benefit of consolidation durvalumab after chemoradiation therapy for locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer, I pose the theoretical question to the faculty. To what extent are the outstanding efficacy findings from this trial a result of synergy between chemotherapy and/or radiation therapy and durvalumab? Put more simply, is this a case of 1 plus 1 equaling 2, or 1 plus 1 equaling 10, or something in between? Dr. Rizvi began the discussion.
I think that the combinations really are the future. I think we need to do them in a more strategic way with biomarkers. In terms of the durvalumab data, I would say that probably everyone in this panel was floored by the magnitude of difference between the placebo and durvalumab consolidation. And I think that the breadth of that benefit sort of across PD-L1 status, even for never smokers, EGFR mutants, I think really to me speaks to some synergy. Whether it's the chemo more than the radiation, I would probably say it's the radiation more than the chemo would be my guess, but it's hard to know for sure. Also, the magnitude of the benefit was greater the closer you gave it to finishing the treatment, suggesting you're either it's the patients were better PS or you're actually capitalizing on that synergy.
That's interesting. Dave, any thoughts about this? What do you think about these kinds of strategies? And from your point of view, what do you think about the PACIFIC trial? Do you think there's synergy the way Nair was talking about? And what about anti-angiogenics and other strategies?
I do think the renal cell data with VEGF receptor TKIs looks very promising, and hopefully we'll see some of that in some other tumor settings. You know, synergy to me is the 1 plus 1 equals 10, and I'm not sure I've seen that yet. When I think about chemotherapy and immunotherapy, the data we have, there's definitely an improvement in things that are more tangible, like response rate. So in other words, the combination is better than what you get with either alone. But I'm not sure that it's 1 plus 1 equals 10. And sometimes I was joking before this meeting, maybe it's 1 plus 1 equals 1.5, you know, that it's better than either agent alone, but I'm not sure how much more you're getting from the two together for things like response. But I think synergy, if it's going to be seen, might be from the more extended benefits. So if your immune system's activated and you're months past chemotherapy, perhaps the platinum doublet chemotherapy for sure, getting benefit like that might be the sustained synergy that immunotherapy brings, but we really don't know.
So, Vali, you know, actually, when I say synergy, I kind of mean pharmacologic synergy, because there could be, you know, clinical reasons. For example, giving a checkpoint inhibitor just earlier might be beneficial. It might not be the combination. Any thoughts about this broad question, Vali?
I think I'm somewhere in the middle between Dr. Rizvi's response and Dr. Spiegel's response, in the sense that I believe the magnitude of benefit was impressive. I don't think it speaks for synergy, but I think selecting populations, we may actually see synergy with either sequences or combinations. For example, in the PACIFIC data, we know that subset analysis show evidence of increased benefit for patients that had wild-type tumors versus EGFR, and also low PD-L1 expression subset did not appear to benefit as much. Now, those are gross selection criteria. I think with better selection, better biomarkers for any given combination, we may actually expect to see synergy.
So, Corey, I was just fantasizing, we come back to AACR 10 years ago, and I go, remember we talked about that question 10 years ago? Now we know the answer. What is the answer? Corey, do you believe in the abscopal effect clinically? Have you ever observed it?
I have observed it, rarely. See it a little bit more perhaps in melanoma, it's certainly been shown. Anecdotally, we've seen 2 out of 20 patients on a similar non-small cell trial truly have an abscopal effect, but it's rare. And I think that is not something that we necessarily can capitalize on. When it comes to this, I don't think I've ever seen 1 plus 1 equals 10. Maybe 1 plus 1 equals 3, and particularly when we look at the Durva data from Pacific for PFS, where we've tripled it. But I'm inclined to agree with Dave. I think when it comes to survival, particularly because of so many of the other clinical factors, 1 plus 1 equals 1.5 or 1.7 is an excellent outcome. And I'll show you some data where 1 plus 1 equals 0.7, where we actually do worse. And I think that's also comes through with TKIs plus immunotherapy, particularly in lung cancer, where we do see synergy, but it's toxicity and not necessarily benefit. So I'm going to leave it to Nair and others who spend a lot more time in the translational world to show us what marker or composite set of markers will truly enable us to achieve synergy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I looked at those renal data and said, well, axitinib's a really good drug. You know, you see good responses with that. So interesting. Well, let's probe a little bit more into the granularity of the topic here tonight. And we're going to talk about checkpoint inhibitors in the locally advanced setting. We wanted to just sort of put out a few sort of clinical issues to get the faculty to relate to. So the first, again, more along the theoretical lines, in terms of immune therapy, Nair, what's your take in terms of microscopic versus macroscopic? Clearly, we see macroscopic. Now we're seeing in this durvalumab trial effects at the microscopic level. Any thoughts about immunotherapy and microscopic versus macroscopic disease?
The durvalumab may be somewhere in the middle because, I mean, these patients often had big tumors. I mean, they all do mostly recur, so there probably still is a lot of viable cancer in a lot of these patients. But some of the work that Christian Blank did in melanoma, looking at neoadjuvant therapy versus adjuvant in melanoma, you know, showed that when you give it neoadjuvantly, when the tumor is present, you get more broad polyclonal T cell expansion. When you give immunotherapy, when the tumor is there versus adjuvantly, when it's not there, you don't see as broad a response. So maybe, you know, having tumor antigens present that can lead to epitope spreading and sort of lighting a fire with tumor present may actually be more robust. There's a plethora of both neoadjuvant and adjuvant trials exploring that in lung cancer.
Of course, when you say it's not there, you mean clinically, because theoretically it's there microscopically, but whether it makes a difference, we can speculate on. So let's start to get into the clinical aspects of the data we're going to talk about today, Dave. And we asked this question. We know that people in general are certainly moved towards durvalumab as a standard after consolidation treatment. But there are a couple subsets that we've seen some controversy about. Patients with targetable mutation, EGFR, for example, and patients with low PD-L1 levels. The majority of the audience says give it to everybody. Dave, agree or disagree?
Yeah, that's what I voted for as well. I think if you look at the intent to treat analysis, which we'll go through, you know, everybody benefits. So it is true in the subsets, there's some interesting questions about patients with low or no PD-L1 expression and that affected the label in Europe, but not in the United States. But I think at the end of the day, we don't know for sure that patients wouldn't benefit if you didn't have any expression. Likewise, if you had an activating mutation, EGFR or ALK rearrangement, that you wouldn't benefit. And so the standard of care, I believe, is this, durvalumab following chemoradiotherapy for stage 3 disease.
So a couple other issues that come up clinically in people with locally advanced disease. Bally, we wanted to see where the audience was. The first question: we know there's some people who are considered not eligible for chemo radiation therapy because they're not eligible for chemo, they're older, they have comorbidities, they're frail, et cetera. And sometimes radiation therapy for palliation is used in this situation. The question is, what about a patient like that using consolidation durvalumab? The audience seems a little bit split, but inclined to certainly consider it. And before you respond, Valley, let me let you take a look at the next one, which is a patient who's getting surgery as part of treatment for locally advanced disease. And here, it looks like the audience, again, even though this did not fit the criteria of the Pacific trial, it looks like people are interested potentially in going beyond it. So what about, first of all, Valley, the older person who's only getting radiation therapy, would you consider or offer consolidation durvalumab?
So this is not the information that we received from Pacific, so certainly it would be outside the scope of what the clinical trial accomplished. However, theoretically, there is reason to believe that patients would benefit from the addition of consolidation immunotherapy on top of radiation therapy, And there is a multitude of clinical trials exploring this question right now. So I agree with the audience that it can be considered. It is unlikely that we will be covered by insurance, though, based on the data that we had. It's a totally different question that we're answering with a surgical question here. These patients have not received radiation therapy, so pretty much we're asking the question that trials such as ANVIL with adjuvant nivolumab versus placebo is answering. And I'm not really sure that we can recommend this on the basis of the PACIFIC data in the absence of radiation therapy.
So, Dave, any thoughts on this? You know, yeah. I don't want to say what would you do if it were you, but what would you do? No, really.
So for the first case, the easy way out of that is if you try chemo, it's too hard, you stop it, you'll get durvalumab approved because you tried, but you couldn't finish it.
Are you saying you kind of do it just to be able to access it? Does that mean you would?
If you have some question about whether you'll get it, I'd have no problem with the first case.
So you're okay with it?
So the way I answered it is no, but I just did it. Here's my quick thought about it. So a young guy came into my office who went to surgery for what was thought to be resectable disease, but when they got in there, as you know what happens, you find N2 disease. Had we known that ahead of time, and they tried, they sampled the mediastinum, we never would have sent him to surgery at our center. We would have given him PACIFIC. So he went to surgery, had N2 disease, came out of it.
So he didn't have an excision, or did they try to excise the tumor?
No, they did excise the tumor.
They
excised it. So now he has positive N2 disease resected, in that, which is what this case is. And so I was on the heels of the latest PACIFIC data, and I thought he deserves a chance at PACIFIC, because had he never gone to surgery, that's the way I would have treated him. That's not the standard. Technically, you shouldn't do that, but I did do it for this gentleman.
But you would argue that in this case, you would prescribe radiation therapy anyway this patient.
Yeah, he got radiation.
So then you have some justification of prescribing consolidation post-radiation.
He got post-op radiotherapy.
So it sounds like, Val, if he came to you for a second opinion, you say, I agree with Dr. Spiegel?
I would say that if the patient never receives radiation, which would not be the standard of care, the standard of care for this patient is chemo and radiation. I would add consolidation after that, because this is now brings us back exactly to the same paradigm as PACIFIC.
So a third opinion, he goes to Philadelphia and sees you, Corey.
And I would actually spice things up by saying no. This patient would have never gone on PACIFIC with the definitive surgical excision. If there had been no radiation, I agree with Val that this patient would have been an excellent candidate for ANVIL, where it remains an open question. Remember, they're looking at NEVO versus observation for the same relative year. I'm totally on the fence when it comes to trimodality, which I think is what you're implying here. But going back to what Nair said, the tumor's out. Presumably the immune microenvironment that may have been a setup for antigen release may no longer be the case. I don't know if that really operates here, but I think we have a different set of expectations for these drugs once the tumor's out.
Neil, real quick, the gentleman I just told you about, for reasons that we can get into maybe at another time, he had a MET exon 14 skip mutation as well. And he's a scientist, and so you can imagine those conversations.
Wow. So are you going to integrate targeted crizotinib into this?
No, but it came up in conversation.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. So, Corey, you know, coming from a background of doing oncology all across the board, we're kind of numeracy-oriented. I think this comes out of breast cancer, you know, rather than online model from many years ago. But we've been starting to ask numeracy questions in a lot of settings. So, you know, no patients are going to ask these questions. So we thought we'd ask you a few questions along those lines. So Corey, you have a patient who's about to undergo chemo radiation therapy for stage 3 disease. We're just asking as a broad, you know, sort of global estimate. What would you estimate the chance that this person's going to have disease progression in the next year and a half?
I respect the people, the 13% who said, I don't know. I think they may be the most honest. If we look at the data from PACIFIC, it's probably in that 50 to 60% range, but it's not just metastases. It's local recurrence, it's other manifestations. But even there, I think that may be subject to change over time. And I think it underscores the lack of real understanding or appreciation of where the data go that we see such a broad range here.
We know that, you know, we don't have perfect clinical research data to provide every number that every patient would have to have, but we also know people ask you and say, you know, give us your best thought. And if they understand the concept of, you know, sort of adjuvant therapy, they can, you know, really ask these questions. Because the key question then, Corey, just to follow up. But before we go on, Valerie, do you agree with 60%? I've heard people say higher than that.
It's higher than that in Pacific. The PFS at 18 months without durvalumab, if you look at those lines on the curve, it says 27%. So actually, 73% of the patients would have progressed without durvalumab. With durvalumab, it's something like 46% PFS, so about 50% would progress even with durvalumab. Now, that's specific data. We need to look at
you know, when a patient asks broader, too, you know, it's obviously you're integrating your clinical experience, other trial data, et cetera. I guess here's a critical question, Nair, in terms of, you know, patient education or information, which is whatever you think that risk is, how much absolutely, not relatively, absolute risk reduction do you obtain at 18 months? How would you answer it, Nair?
Probably, you know, sort of in the 40% range, yeah.
I would just point out that's a pretty high number compared to many adjuvant situations across oncology in terms of absolute benefit. So, Valerie, I've heard this question posed, which of course we don't have the data for, but I'm just kind of curious what you think, which is optimally, what would be the optimal duration of consolidation durvalumab in this setting? Could we have gotten away with a couple months? Or would the patients have done better if they had longer therapy? Of course, we don't know, but I'm, Valerie, just kind of curious about your speculation.
Speculation will be based, it's completely speculative, on the basis that we are treating micrometastatic disease, and we know from the metastatic disease setting that 1 year was not enough with nivolumab, and therefore, likely a longer duration would be better.
Okay.
I just don't know what the magic number may be.
So again, maybe when we come back in 10 years, we will know the number. So Dave, here's a question from the chat room, from the audience, maybe follow up to your comments. If you have a patient with stage 3 who gets neoadjuvant chemo radiation therapy, then goes to surgery but has a positive margin, would you use durvalumab?
It's an odd case. So I had preoperative chemo RT, because usually we'd give RT for that positive margin afterwards. I don't know what I would do there. I mean, Durva doesn't feel like that fits. The Pacific doesn't fit with that. Yet there's known disease at the margin. I guess I would explore any other local options for that patient and then watch them.
Nair, second opinion?
I mean, I think, again, it's a patient by patient, but I think, you know, somebody like that, maybe they probably shouldn't have had surgery, and if they, you know, had a positive margin. So I would probably give someone like that a consolidation durva.
In the second module, we talked about the incidence and management of toxicities with the use of anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies. We asked the audience, based on the data from the Pacific trial, what they would estimate to be the likelihood that a patient who was started on durvalumab consolidation would be able to complete a year of therapy. And the responses were in the range of 40 to 60%. But I asked Dr. Papadimitra Kapulu for her thoughts.
The completion of 1 year of therapy is highly dependent on the patient's performance status at the end of chemoradiation therapy. So patients that have a hard time completing that course have a hard time maintaining treatment with durvalumab. My experience has been that almost 100% of my patients have been able to complete that year, but I'm not sure that this reflects the community practice. There is some hardship associated with frequent travel if the patient is not getting therapy closer to home, because it's every 2 weeks. And there is some lingering fatigue that is associated with the use of durvalumab for a year.
It's interesting that you say now you're getting your patients through, because remember, when they went through the trial, they didn't know there was a 50% relative risk reduction.
Right.
Now your patients
have in mind
the goal.
There
Maybe they're more motivated to get through. Corey, when we drafted this question, one of our reviewers said, is there an answer to this? So here's the question. You have had a real leadership role looking at treatment of older patients, and I think there actually are some data on this. Do you see greater toxicity in older patients, Corey? You can make an argument either way. Maybe their immune system's not as spiffed up.
And for that reason, maybe they have less toxicity. I think at the end of the day, it's probably about the same. You've got to realize when you look at advanced disease trials, many of the elderly don't get as much treatment as younger patients and may not have had quite as much exposure. But there doesn't seem to be any particular reason why they would have more toxicity.
So Valerie, we said in the Pacific trial, pneumonitis occurred in both treatment arms with similar rates of grade 3 events. Most events were grade 1, 2. the audience in general says yes. You agree?
Yes, 60% of the audience says they agree, and that's correct.
Okay, and then the next point is this issue, Valley. Of patients who got pneumonitis, the time to onset was similar. In the durvalumab and placebo group, audience says yes.
So I think the majority voted yes, and that's consistent with the data.
Third question about pneumonitis, there's no difference in durvalumab treatment exposure, presence or absence of pneumonitis. Seems like the same 50-some percent.
Yes.
Am I correct in saying that pretty much every patient who gets chemo radiation therapy for locally advanced lung cancer has radiation changes in the lung fields?
That would be a fair statement.
Dave, you can pick up on the second part of this. Then how do you say that somebody has grade one? Not everybody had grade one, so you try to differentiate whether imaging-wise it looks like immune or beyond the radiation field? Or
well, I think what we're all looking for are symptoms. Before you begin durvalumab, kind of regardless of what the scan looks like, are patients symptomatic? That's what I use to make a decision. Are we going to start now? Are we going to start later? Or are we going to ever start? You know, we've all, in stage four disease, we've dealt with this. Stage three, you know you get radiation changes in the lungs, and it can be hard to distinguish later what's related to durvalumab, what's not. So
I was just thinking, actually, Nair, from the point of view of the trial and the reporting, when you report grade one, like, what's it based on?
It's purely radiologic.
So they'd say it looks like immune-related as opposed to radiation-related? I mean,
I'm not sure how they reported it. I mean, clinically,
it just got scored. It wasn't the investigator's responsibility to say treatment-related or not. You just had to score whether
it was lumped together.
It's radiologic.
Actually, pneumonitis and radiation pneumonitis is one category in the adverse event.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. The key point here is that any grade pneumonitis and radiation pneumonitis was seen in 33% on the durvalumab arm and 24.8% on placebo. There is no significant difference. What's most important, what we worry about, is grade 3 and 4 events, and those were pretty much the same, 3.6 and 3% in the two arms. Outcome of death was 1.1 versus 2.1 and leading to discontinuation, 6 versus 4.3. So pretty much similar between the two arms.
So Dave, outside a protocol setting, and of course this subject comes up all the time, no matter when we talk about checkpoint inhibitors, the patients with prior autoimmune disease, we said Crohn's, on infliximab, but well controlled. But the interesting thing about these questions, as opposed to when we ask these questions about metastatic diseases, they actually have a chance of cure without it. So the risk is in a different context. So Dave, the audience looks pretty split about this kind of case. Would you use durvalumab?
Well, so I said no here because of the infliximab. That makes me nervous. I could see myself agreeing if the patient wanted to do it, but I would think the chances for a complication are very high.
So here's the other one we talk about all the time, Dave, the patient who's had an organ transplant. We said kidney. Most of the audience says no. On the other hand, I hear people, of course, in metastatic disease, you hear people saying, well, you can go on dialysis, et cetera, you're going to die the other way, but this is a different situation. How about transplant, Dave?
Yeah, so I haven't had this happen yet, but I've certainly been in meetings where everyone is no, 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 don't do it. So I voted no because I assume some people have had some bad experiences. I just don't know. I feel a little bit better about this in terms of how I deal with it if it happened, but I still voted no.
You know, we were at the ASCO GI meeting that when we were doing a thing with HCC, the question came up, status post-hepatic transplant. So hepatic and heart tends to get a lot scarier than kidney, but nonetheless, hopefully it's a curative situation. A couple of quick questions from the audience, Valley. One, does the chemotherapy backbone used in the chemo radiation have any impact on outcomes or toxicity?
So in general terms, I don't think the effect of chemotherapy has been studied on the effects on the severity of the immune-related adverse events. There is some theoretical advantage in adding chemotherapy in that you add some degree of immunosuppression, and therefore you may not see the grade 3 events that you would see otherwise. But certainly there is no significant difference that we have observed between clinical trials containing chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor versus checkpoint inhibitor alone.
So Corey, any comments, particularly in this specific setting?
In Pacific, I agree with Val that doesn't appear to be much influenced by the nature of the chemo on either outcome or potential toxicity. In advanced disease, that may be a little bit different. In the KEYNOTE-189 trial, an unanticipated toxicity that seemed to occur a bit more than we thought was nephritis and renal impairment, about 5% having some elevation in creatinine, in some cases fairly severe, that you wouldn't necessarily see either with chemo alone or with pembro alone.
So Nair, we often go through, we talk about metastatic disease, people who may be on therapy longer, et cetera. Maybe some of the cases you have CTLA-4 coming in, but specifically in the issue of consolidation durvalumab, I'm curious about your experience. Do you see thyroid dysfunction? Have you seen colitis? Are you seeing things other than pneumonitis?
I think that probably the pneumonitis is still a little bit greater in my experience from patients I've treated, and I've had a couple of, you know, bad pneumonitis cases that have given me pause. You know, I would encourage the audience to be, you know, vigilant for monitoring these patients. In terms of other toxicity profiles, it does seem pretty similar in the consolidation setting versus the metastatic setting.
So, Dave, whenever somebody presents a strange case, I always go to you because you're going to say, oh, yeah, I've seen a couple of these people. So tell me if you've seen this one, Dave. Stage 4, non-small cell, PD-1 60%, getting pembro first line, gets chest pain. Troponin elevated, EKGs normal, cardiac cath negative, but CK was high. Mild AKI and suspected rhabdo. Have you seen rhabdo with checkpoint inhibitors, rhabdomyolysis?
So I haven't, but my partner in clinic a few weeks ago had. He came up to me and he said, David, have you ever seen this? And I said, no, it's been reported. And like that week, we got an INDSR describing rhabdo out there. So that first case I've heard about, it wasn't my patient. Cardiac, I've actually not had a patient with any cardiac issues yet, but I'm aware of my partner's had one recently, actually Johanna.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. The patient went into heart failure or what?
No, ended up having CKMB elevated and probably myocardial muscle wall damage, but
wow,
not a coronary event.
Interesting.
In the next module, we discuss the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer and actionable mutations. To begin, we ask the audience what they would recommend for a patient with metastatic non-squamous disease and no targetable mutations and a PD-L1 TPS of 10%. About 50% chose pembrolizumab in combination with carboplatin pemetrexed and asked Dr. Langer if he agreed.
This is a classic 189 patient, certainly less than 50%. You can make an argument for the triplet versus chemo alone, and the majority picked that. I'm intrigued that 17% chose the IMpower 150 regimen, the quadruplet regimen, suggesting perhaps that that approach may be gaining some traction.
Yeah, that is interesting. About a third of the people here would use atezolizumab. Interesting. In any event, so next, Dave, this is the one we've had a lot of debate about. The patient who has a TPS of 50% or over, and a lot of people, obviously you can give single agent checkpoint therapy with pembrolizumab, and that is the most common answer. Dave, agree or disagree?
So, yeah, I did an event with you and Corey. I was on the opposite side of things, so I was all about monotherapy, and Corey had just presented 21G. But I've swung to the other side. So I am a big fan of the Corey Langer, Lena Gandhi regimen, carbo-pem-pem. The response rates are higher than you get with monotherapy with pembrolizumab, high expressing. PD-L1 patients do fantastic with this. Is it more than they need? I don't know, but it's a pretty good regimen.
So, Corey, have you switched tunes? Because we asked the faculty to answer this question. And Corey, I see you say pembro. Did you flip?
I actually chose pembro here, only because it's the standard of care.
You know something I don't.
But I would have low threshold to do the triplet, particularly in folks who have aggressive disease, relatively low comorbidities. If this had been an 80-year-old, I suspect Dave might have agreed with me and used pembro alone.
Well, he was trying to agree with you, but you changed before you could...
No, I still tend to use the triplet, but 50%, we will be doing a trial through ECOG and SWOG that's directly going to compare in this population single agent to the triplet.
We can get into it. When KEYNOTE-024 came out, monotherapy, I jumped on that bandwagon and treated as many patients as I could. And then I had two patients with 100% PD-L1 expression who went downhill quickly, and I couldn't rescue them with chemotherapy.
Wow.
And that changed the way I practiced. And when Corey's data I was skeptical on, just because he's the first one to tell you phase two data, you need to be skeptical. And then 189 happened at this meeting. And that convinced me that that's a good regimen for my high expressing patients. And I'm throwing everything I have at them, and carbopem's a pretty good regimen. I know how to manage that, so that's what I do.
So here, Nier, is the other classic, i.e., we've been asking it the last 2 years, question, which is the patient who's symptomatic, but has a high TPS, and we bumped it all the way up to 90%. The audience looks pretty split about how to approach it, whether chemotherapy, Nier, what do you say?
I mean, I try to give single agent PD-1 as much as I can. If they have, you know, something symptomatic, I might, you know, try to radiate it and give them pembro at the same time. My preference for PD-L1 positives is almost always to give them single agent PD-1. And I think that I'm concerned about how much deleterious effects the chemotherapy has on memory T cells and durability of response. And if you look at the responders to chemo pembro versus the responders to pembro, to me, the durability, I mean, it's only emerging data now, but probably, you know, single agent PD-1 is more durable in nature if you respond. So I think this may be the case where you're getting 1+1 with chemo plus pembro, but then, you know, what are you getting minus-wise in terms of that long-term durable, you know, remission you're trying to achieve?
I just had a general medical oncology sort of thought about levels of ER in breast cancer. And where it seems like if you're positive, you're positive. Is that the way you look at it, or is 90% different to you than 50?
There is some retrospective data that the higher, the 90, 100% have a higher response rate than if you're 50 to 60%.
So a couple other things. One, of course, the issue of patients with targetable mutations. Corey, so we said you've got a patient who's got an EGFR tumor mutation in general, and we're saying that PD-L1 is elevated. So in general, where would you fit in a checkpoint inhibitor in a patient like that? And interestingly, actually a quarter of the audience says first line. I'm curious if there's a wrong answer in your opinion here, Corey. And generally, where would you introduce a checkpoint inhibitor?
I think first line is the wrong answer. We have data in those who have an oncogenic driver plus high levels of PD-L1 that single agent checkpoint inhibitor doesn't really work all that well. The data are limited, but they're quite compelling. So you treat always with the TKI up front. Once they're TKI refractory, then a potential role probably in combination with chemo. I'm not sure I would do it as a single agent even then. My go-to regimen until recently was PEM-CARBO-BEV, and then checkpoint inhibitor really is third or fourth line.
And here we actually asked the audience that question specifically, Corey, which is probably the most common scenario right now with first-line osimertinib, getting out to 18 months with then disease progression. It's interesting. Initially, people were saying give the chemo and then checkpoint later. And then the Empower data came out and people started to say, okay, chemo plus. But what do you think, Corey, about the answer of pembro alone?
I'd be a little bit leery. Again, chemo, I think, has a proven track record. You go back to the original IPASS data, the response rate to chemo was double in the EGFR mutant contingent compared to the wild type cohort. And probably the answer that really has data here.
You're saying response rate to targeted therapy.
Yeah, this is for targeted. This is the original IPASS trial.
Right, yeah.
So the answer that actually has data is the next to last, the quadruplet that had an EGFR mutant cohort. And TKI refractory actually had an amazing hazard ratio of about 0.53 when it came to survival. So all the rest either have no data or may have somewhat disturbing data.
Yeah, I think it's probably a bad idea to give, you know, an EGFR mutant who progresses on TKI single agent pembro. I mean, if you look at the KEYNOTE-001 data, the never smokers who had were PD-L1 high, they didn't respond as well, and their durability was extremely low. And I remember, you know, in KEYNOTE-2442, those patients were actually excluded from those trials. So they're not behaving the same way as a PD-L1 positive in the rest of the population.
So another question, Dave, and actually we got a question in the chat room about this. Hyperprogression, do you believe in it? Does it exist? It looks like the audience thinks it does. I've heard a lot of questioning of it.
You know,
are you a believer or non-believer, Dave?
So I was going through the ACR list of sessions, and there's a whole session on this, so that must mean it really exists, but I don't believe in it. I've not seen it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I just have not seen it.
Well, clearly you've seen people go downhill, but obviously the disease could be a very likely, if not possible, explanation.
There's something called progression, simply.
Yeah.
So another question, Corey, re-challenge after durvalumab consolidation, Corey. So we asked the audience, a patient develops metastatic disease 18 months later. They say, yeah, they re-challenge with a checkpoint inhibitor. You agree? And what about if it's quicker, let's say 9 months?
So I'd have different answers. If it is 18 months, I'd certainly consider it, either alone or potentially in combination with chemo. But if they're actually refractory, if the disease is progressing despite DURVA or ongoing PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibition, I'll go with chemo or chemo-bev.
So final question, Nair, and again, this comes up all the time when you go to the next one, which is duration of treatment in the metastatic setting. Patient who's doing well, tolerating therapy well, would you stop treatment at any point in time? Half the audience says no, they would keep it going. But quite a few people, the other half, would say, yeah, we'd stop after a year, after 2 years. Nair, again, this is a metastatic disease. Patient's doing well. Would you stop therapy?
I stop at 2 years. I mean, I think that we don't know the answer. I think that, in general, some of the earlier trials, you know, with Pembro did stop at 2 years, and they typically did very well. So I wouldn't continue these drugs indefinitely.
Just curious, how many people have you stopped therapy in? Have you seen any recurrences after that?
No. I've treated a lot, but I haven't seen recurrences.
You've stopped yeah. therapy in a lot of patients.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, we just saw longer-term data that Roy Herbst presented at ESMO, that if you made it to 2 years on Pembro with a deep response, like almost everybody makes it out to 3, 4, or more years. So
Dave, you're also a two-year believer?
Yeah, because those were the way the studies were designed. So
but I mean, clinically, those. That's what you're doing?
That's what I do.
And again, how many times have you done it? Have you seen people relapse after that?
So I've seen it happen, not in the first line setting yet, but where I used to give checkpoint inhibitor as a second or later line therapy, I've seen it happen there where I've stopped it at 2 years and folks have recurred.
I guess it gets more complicated if you're giving Pembro and chemotherapy
yes,
as maintenance.
Right.
What do you do for those patients?
Really complicated.
A couple other questions. Corey, again, from the chat room. Is there biologic reason to think that anti-VEGF therapy might be effective in EGFR mutated disease, which of course we know Bev, there's these findings, and maybe that explains what's going on with these chemo IO patients.
What's particularly intriguing when you look at IMpower 150, which is the only trial that included anti-angiogenesis, in this setting, the separation of the curves seems to be even more pronounced once the chemo's done. So suggesting perhaps some potential additivity, if not synergy, for angiogenesis and checkpoint inhibition together. I'd love to see that exploited further, and there are a number of trials now looking at various immunoangioinhibitory combos in the refractory setting, TKI refractory.
But independently, EGFR or VEGFR is a parameter of resistance for EGFR mutated disease, and we have positive trials in frontline.
Absolutely.
With combination of TKIs and
so, Dave, another good question. I don't know if this is a real name or not, but if it is, I think it trumps mine. Dr. Honeydew. Anyhow, maybe. I like it. Anyhow, Dr. Honeydew wants to know, combining IO with targeted therapy, what do we know about that? For example, EGFR TKIs, Dave.
Yeah, so we know a little. There's been some data that have come out from the Farber group. Jeff Oxnard has published some data of some toxicity concerns in a study called the Tatton trial. We, in our center, along with those around the country, we found some very negative experience with nivolumab and crizotinib with some severe liver issues, and so that has come to a halt. You know, I think for me, the ALK combinations look to be concerning for liver potential issues. The EGFR combinations, I think, still have a chance and are still being developed, but there are some concerns in terms of toxicities, namely pneumonitis.
So final question to Nair. Can you talk a little bit about your vision of what's going on in these patients with mutations? Is it really about tumor mutation burdens? They're non-smokers. That's kind of the phenotype of their cancers. And it looks like most of this data is EGFR. What about other mutations, particularly BRAF, where you see in smokers? Is that any different? And then do you approach them differently?
I mean, I think these EGFR mutants probably had a much, you know, shorter timeline of the cancer developing, whereas a smoker may have had chronic sort of mutagen exposure over 20 years, leading to a more profound adaptive immune escape environment, which is being targeted by immune checkpoint inhibitors, you know, where you have that upregulation of PD-L1 and other immune escape molecules, where EGFR mutations is usually more clonal, more single, you know, mutation, more rapid timeline of evolution. It's just a different biology.
So, Corey, what about BRAF? If you have, let's say, a smoker who has BRAF, you're still going to follow the same kind of model?
I would still start off with TKI combination and then probably go with not immunotherapy alone, but probably a chemo-immunotherapy combo, though I think I would be a little bit less worried in that group, particularly since they are more likely to have been smokers, about immunotherapy alone. For the ALK and EGFR group, I reserve immunotherapy for a combo or third line or fourth line. I will never do it front line.
This was looked at, actually. There was a study that looked at all the patients, the ones with, let's say, guideline recommended biomarkers, and the only group that stood out was BRAF mutants in terms of their response.
Really?
To
they
immune
responded
checkpoints.
Better?
Yes, they do respond
better.
At least
as good. I don't know. Yeah.
Interesting. Dave, what about PD-L1 levels in these patients? I've heard cases described to me. I remember Ross Kamage was talking about patients with ALK who had like 100% PD-L1 and don't respond. What's going on there?
We get called about this frequently where someone finds an L858R mutation and 100% PD-L1 expression because it's part of the panel that gets done. And the question that we get asked is, should I start, pembrolizumab? And so, we say no and recommend the TKI. So Corey alluded to a study that Eddie Guerin and the UCLA group did looking at patients who had EGFR mutations and high PD-L1 expression and exposed those patients to monotherapy pembro, and the outcomes were poor. Corey correctly points out the numbers were small, and actually when I ask Eddie about the kind of mutations they studied, it wasn't exactly always sensitizing mutations that went onto that trial, so the typical deletion 19 and L858Rs, although they had some. It appeared to be some other, even exon 20 insertions that went on that study. So I still think we don't know. I'd be nervous about doing that outside of a clinical trial. It is interesting, though, you do melanoma sessions here, and those docs don't shy from giving immunotherapy to V600E, in mutated settings, and they're even doing combination work.
That's because their TMB is the same.
Absolutely, give it instead.
Yeah, that's what gets discussed is differences in TMB, perhaps.
I think we would make a distinction between ALK, ROS1, and EGFR, and then the other potential oncogenic drivers.
Interesting. So, and in melanoma, most of the investigators don't even look at PD-L1 levels, even though the research says maybe there's an indication, but for a clinical point of view, particularly in the BRAF-positive patients.
In the last module, we talked about future directions for clinical research in immunotherapy of lung cancer and emerging data on the use of checkpoint inhibitors in the neoadjuvant setting, including recently presented data on not only non-small cell lung cancer, but in patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer who were unresponsive to BCG. I asked Dr. Langer for his thoughts on this research strategy.
Well, I'm not a GU doctor, but this is very enticing and alluring. We've seen somewhat similar, not quite as impressive data for neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibition in lung cancer. Major pathologic responses of about 10 to 20% with 42% actually with single agent Nevo in this setting, but very few of those were true path CRs. Intriguingly, when you give it with chemo, the path CR rate does exceed 50%. Small trial, the Nadine trial from Spain with 30 patients, all having 3A disease, so locally advanced, at least resectable disease with a very high major path response and PCR rate. So there are a number of phase 3 trials now ongoing comparing neoadjuvant chemo alone to neoadjuvant chemo plus checkpoint inhibition in the resectable setting. And I imagine the results will be known in the next year or two. The combo with chemo is particularly promising, 60% or higher in the NEEM trial, 30% in your effort. The best data we've ever had with chemo alone was the Bedeker trial, which was about a 20% path CR, and it's typically 5 to 10%.
Yeah, and our patients were largely 3A as well, similar to the NEEM trial.
The major pathologic response data has been modified by Memorial very recently because they looked at different histologies. Squamous versus adenoid appears that a different threshold is predictive for each. It's evolving, I think, as a paradigm.
Valerie, is there follow-up data to show that path CR or major CR is correlated with long-term outcomes?
We have data, historical data, even with chemotherapy. This is a white paper that was written by both groups, Memorial, MD Anderson, and others. But I think in the era of immunotherapy, defining major pathologic response and its outcome and using it as an endpoint is still under discussion and in flux.
We'll point out that in breast cancer, even though you see complete pathologic responses, and that is associated with long-term outcome, it really, there's no difference in giving pre-op or post-op. Again, Nair, I know it's just very, very early data, but any sort of theoretical ideas about why checkpoint would help with non-invasive disease?
Potentially, you know, if you have an earlier stage of tumor, maybe it's more clonal in nature, and maybe there's a sort of less of a subclone fractions where we know these immune checkpoints are not as successful.
So the faculty on this next one was split 50-50, but the audience seems a little more clear about it. Dave, do you think that TMB is a factor that you can support as using in clinical decision making?
So I put no here because, you know, that's saying I'm going to use that score to tell me to do something different than what I would do otherwise. And so I don't use it that way. If it came back at zero or a million, it wouldn't change what I'm doing for a patient.
Most people believe there is a correlation. And in terms of the combination, at this point, the Ipi-Nivo data is still maturing. But from what you've seen, do you think there's a difference in combinations from what we've seen at this point?
No, they seem pretty comparable.
Corey, is that your general take? Again, it's a question we've been asking the last few years. It's pretty hard to differentiate PD-L1, PD-1 in terms of different agents in terms of efficacy, or do you think you can differentiate them?
I don't think you can easily differentiate them. They're more comparable than different. Perhaps we'll discuss this later, but like Dave, I'm a bit of a TMB skeptic, and I have yet to make a therapeutic decision in the clinic based on TMB.
I was thinking more about the basic, you know, efficacy data here. Valley, any reason to think that durvalumab, tremelimumab is going to be any different than Ipi-Nivo?
It's a little less toxic than Ipi-Nivo. That's a difference. This is biology, basically, anti-PD-L1 and anti-CTLA-4. And I do believe that the TMB is a predictive biomarker. Unfortunately, there are practical issues here with considering this biomarker that can be widely accepted. I think that's the other side of the coin that maybe we need to discuss.
And then finally, the question of the microbiome and antibiotics and checkpoint inhibitors. Nair, agree or disagree that there is a correlation?
I mean, there's not a lot of data, but I do agree that there does seem to be, you know, something which is there. There was a retrospective analysis looking at those patients that did receive antibiotics versus those that did not. They looked at patients that received within 2 months before or 1 month after the first PD-1 therapy, and they were for common indications such as dental, urinary, and pulmonary infections. They tried to match patients for performance status and comorbidities and other things to try to make sure it wasn't just sick patients that were getting antibiotics, and they tried to match for that. I mean, this retrospective analysis, the OS was 20 months versus 11 months. So, you know, as much as it's retrospective data and you go, well, you know, what does it mean?
I mean, enough that you kind of look at your patients and think twice about giving them an antibiotic if they're on a checkpoint inhibitor, or not that much?
I would avoid it if I could.
You would avoid it. Interesting. Corey? I see a disdain.
I need
look
to see more data. I mean, if somebody needs an antibiotic, you got to do it. But obviously, you might want to shorten the course of antibiotic, perhaps separate it a bit. But I think we have more retrospective data for steroids than antibiotics in this setting.
I agree if they need it, but there's a lot of soft calls as to whether somebody needs it.
And, where we're treating pneumonitis that may or may not exist, and it may just be the cancer.
Just out of curiosity, any ideas about the specific mechanism other than somehow it's affecting the microbiome? Anybody have any ideas specifically if this is true? Why?
Well, there has been some work showing that certain bacterial, you know, species within your micro gut flora are associated with better response to immunotherapy. Why that is, I'm not really sure.
Sounds a little empiric.
I have to look back, but I remember, aren't macrolides also anti-inflammatory? I remember some data there.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's kind of interesting.
I think we do need more data, and there are studies that are looking at fecal microbiota transplants. One trial, which I think is really interesting, to take it from the responders to pembro responders with melanoma to give it to patients. Another is looking at sort of single strains and other approaches to use those sort of 10 bacterial species that I mentioned that were published in that Nature paper in 2019 and giving those species to patients. So we'll see.
Maybe get some of your patients who stopped therapy and see what's inside their bowels, and they got out to 3-4 years.
Subsequent to this meeting on April 11, 2019, the Food and Drug Administration expanded the indication for pembrolizumab to the first-line treatment of patients with stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer who are not candidates for definitive chemoradiation or metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Patients' tumors must have no EGFR or ALK genomic aberrations and express PD-L1 tumor proportion score greater or equal to 1% as determined by the FDA-approved test. Pembrolizumab was previously approved as a single agent for the first-line treatment of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer whose tumors express PD-L1 TPS of greater or equal to 50%. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium at the 2019 AACR meeting.